And we are with the explorer, Andrew Collins. His work, Göbekli Tepe, Genesis of the Gods, incredible story. And, geez, just if you can imagine 12,000-plus years ago, what was going on there. We'll talk with him. We'll take your calls in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Andrew Collins with us. Andrew, how do you think they moved 12,000-plus years ago, these stones? They're huge.
I suppose the answer is I don't actually honestly know. I mean, presumably they just used hundreds and hundreds of people and dragged them along. I mean, they were only bringing them from a distance of about a quarter to half a mile, so it's not too far, not like the stones at Stonehenge, which come
right.
from hundreds of miles
or
away.
Or the pyramids.
But, I mean, to me, what is amazing is the fact that they did it and the motivation behind it. This is what excites me. You know, because you need to try and get into the mindset that of these people. Why would they want to do this? You know, and I think that these people lived in fear of something bad that was going to happen again. And that these people that came in, let's call them the Watchers, the Anunnaki, you know, these very tall, striking-looking people, you know, I think that they pulled together the local people to do this. Because there was obviously some kind of infrastructure there. There was obviously some kind of tiered society existing. Even the archaeologists talk about this. And so, the local people are the people that lived in this region. You know, what I'm more interested in is who these people were that came in
yeah.
and took over the show.
Exactly. Now, is there anything about the structure that... would lead you to believe that it was used for some specific purpose?
Well, I think that we're talking about two functions. One is to access the sky world, which existed among the stars. I believe that they felt that the entrance to this sky world was via the Milky Way, and a particular point on the Milky Way where it breaks into two, at the so-called Great Rift or Cygnus Rift, marked here by the stars of Cygnus. This was seen as the point of exit from this physical universe and the entry into this other realm that they believed existed, and that they could communicate with celestial beings, with the ancestor spirits. They believed it's somewhere they went to in death. They believed it was where the souls came from, you know, prior to birth. And this was the job of the shaman. The shaman, you know, would utilize these circles to make this access. And the reason that they're doing this is to bring this otherworldly communication, you know, to the people, but also to stop anything bad happening again in the world. Because you find that within different shamanic traditions around the world, one of the actual functions of shamans is to make sure that the world continues to exist, you know, that darkness doesn't fall, that the end of time does not take place, that the pole that is seen to hold up the physical universe, the cosmic axis, doesn't tumble and collapse. Because they believe that there was like this structure to the universe, and that it was vulnerable to attack from these cosmic tricksters, which, as I said, seems to be in the form of either a dog, a wolf, or a fox. That seems to be the main symbol. Sometimes it's a lion. And that somehow the shamans had to take on these tricksters to outwit them, to prevent them creating this destruction in the world, which they thought was behind this comet impact. What's interesting is that in different countries around the world, comets are associated with the tails of either wolves or foxes around the world.
Hmm.
And that even certain Mexican tribes, whenever a comet would appear in the sky, would do these ceremonies where they would actually adorn themselves in the costume of wolves or foxes to try and appease these supernatural forms that appeared in the sky. And I think this is a memory of something that occurred that, you know, perhaps 12 to 13,000 years ago, you know, and something that was actually taking place at Göbekli Tepe. You know, this is what they were trying to do, prevent something bad happening in the world again.
Is it possible that the structure leads to where the ETs might have come from?
Absolutely. I mean, only recently, NASA has released details of the first habitable planet, or planet like Earth-like planet, yeah, in a habitable zone, you know, an area that could sustain life like our own. And this was within the Cygnus constellation, which, I mean, I'm sure that there are probably hundreds and thousands of other habitable planets out there. I just like the idea that the first one that they confirm to exist out there is actually in the Cygnus constellation. I think Cygnus was very, very important to these people. They believed that this was the place of the primal cause, the place of God, the place where we came from, the place where we would return to in death. Now, why did they believe that? Of everywhere in the sky, you know, they could have chosen anywhere, but they chose Cygnus.
So what came first, the star system in terms of tying that into Göbekli Tepe, or, you know, was it possible that, you know, it was just random?
Well, I found evidence from across the ancient world and also in the Americas that as early as 10 to 20, possibly even 30,000 years ago, there was a universal belief that the Cygnus constellation was the place of life, represented possibly by some kind of cosmic mother who produced or created the Earth and all life within that Earth, and that they venerated it, they represented it in the caves of France and other places around the world, and showed the Cygnus constellation within there. It's unquestionably one of the earliest recognizable star group that the our Ice Age ancestors represented and revered for some reason, you know, and that shows that there was something special. So that when Göbekli Tepe was constructed around 9500 BC, by this time, this belief in the power of Cygnus was already tens of thousands of years old. So clearly the belief was there long before Göbekli Tepe. They already believed and knew that this was the point of entry and exit to the sky world. This was the place where they could go to communicate with the celestial beings. And, you know, who knows, maybe they were, you know, extraterrestrials from other planets that existed in the Cygnus constellation.
All right, let's go to the phones. You ready? Let's
Absolutely.
Go to Chris, truck driving in Pennsylvania, east of the Rockies. Hey, Chris, go ahead. Thank you for calling.
Hey, George, how you doing today?
Good, everybody's good.
I was wondering if your guest has ever been out to Mosul, to that monastery out there in Iraq.
Nope, I have never actually been to Iraq. Obviously, it's been a very difficult place to get into. I've been to the border of Iraq and visited various of the prehistoric places associated with Göbekli Tepe there, but I never actually crossed over the border. And what's so interesting is that within the mountains there is a indigenous ethnic religion known as the Yazidis. They're known as the angel worshippers, and they actually retain beliefs and traditions about these human angels that actually existed within this region, perhaps even, you know, 10 to 12,000 years ago, which we call the Watchers, the Nephilim, the Anunnaki. They have these beliefs, and that's part of their religion even today. And they exist within the mountains of southeast Turkey, northern Iraq now. And I've met some of these people, and it's very extraordinary. And I think that their beliefs go back to this age. They're called the Yazidis.
I had spent a little bit of time over in Mosul, and up in the one area above the Tigris River there, they had this monastery that was set up there where the monks would go in and do their prayer and write the Quran and all that through these echo chambers, which was, it was somewhat in ruins when I was out there in 2007. But in all reality, it's still, you know, majorly intact. And it was, very interesting to realize that this place had been there for thousands of years. And they, at one time, were claiming that that was one of the oldest known monasteries in the world.
Do you think one day, Andrew, that they might find the Ark of the Covenant?
I'm with probably Graham Hancock on this, that if you're going to look for it, then I think you need to go to Ethiopia.
In that church.
I think he built a very good case to suggest that it was constructed and ended its days in a church in Ethiopia. But, I mean, obviously we're talking about, you know, these Bible stories and the impact. All of this, I think, can be taken back to Göbekli Tepe. What we have in the book of Genesis, the different stories, you know, relating to the Garden of Eden, the rivers of paradise, Adam and Eve, being, you know, the first parents of us, committing this original sin, which I think relates to this knowledge that was given to us by the watchers, you know, by these builders of Göbekli Tepe, and somehow it being seen to be too much too soon. You know, all of these stories go back possibly 10 to 12,000 years, which is quite extraordinary, really.
It really does. I mean, way, way back. Let's go to Wes in Wetmore, Kansas. Hey, Wes, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hello, George.
Hi.
You're a really good friend overnight, by the way.
Good. Thank you.
Anyway, I'd like to throw a couple of things out to you and see what your guest thinks of them.
Sure.
When I get done, I'll just listen on the off the phone.
Okay.
I'm thinking with all these ancient monuments that we're finding, and they're all over the world, there's a couple of things I've been tossing around. One of them is that before men were here, angels actually inhabited the earth, okay, and somehow they destroyed it. And then men came along, okay, and they had at first 10 times the lifespan that we have today. And when you throw in the film with that, with the watchers mating with the human women, I would think that it's because the DNA was stronger then. And then, like, after the flood, the lifespan started getting real short. And so our DNA isn't strong enough for them to breed with us anymore. And that's why all the UFOs have all these experiments when they abduct people. And those are just a few things I'd like to throw out. And then I'll listen off the air for any comments.
Okay. Thanks. You want to comment to any of that, Andrew?
Well, Wes, there's some very interesting ideas there. Obviously, we're talking about a long time ago with Göbekli Tepe, 10, 12,000 years ago. But prior to this time, what we call humankind today, they had rivals. You know, there were different types of humanity existed. I've already mentioned the Neanderthals. There's another type of human species called the Denisovans, who were discovered recently, evidence of them in a cave in Siberia. There was other types of what they call human subspecies that existed, and all of these look differently. And the latest evidence is that they all interbred and created hybrids. And these hybrids would have thought differently to us today. Some of them would have thought much more dreamlike, would have spent, you know, their time, visions and dreams, stuff like this. Others much more survival-based, rationalized. And, you know, it's the mixtures of these different types of human species in the past that I think came together that have created what we know as civilization today. And also the memories in the different myths and legends of these mythical beings, you know, these immortals that existed across, you know, human time spans of lives. We call them the Watchers, the Nephilim, the Anunnaki. We can call them the vampires. We can call them, you know, the immortals. But we're talking about a memory of something, I think, that happened on this planet possibly tens of thousands of years ago. And we're only now beginning to unravel it. And I think that we've found a major key in human hybrids, people that look strikingly different to ourselves. And, you know, these people coming into areas, new territories, taking over, becoming the ruling elite, and the memory of them being written down or certainly passed down orally for thousands of years, and then eventually them becoming written into texts like the Book of Genesis, like the Book of Enoch, like the Sumerian myths and legends of the Anunnaki. You know, obviously things get a little bit messed up, you know, across the millennia, but this is there, and they are memories of real events that went on in our human past. But I think it's also important to remember that there was a time when us humans, Homo sapiens sapiens, did not rule the world. You know, these hybrids almost certainly were far more dominant than we were, you know, and that this is something, as I said, that only now we're beginning to understand. And that's why these stories are so mixed up, and we need to disentangle them and get to the root of the whole thing.
Are we finding anything like Göbekli Tepe? Anything out there?
Well, the only other thing which is opening up at the moment is a place in the Philippines called Gudung Padang, which I think you're going to hear an awful lot about. It's this hill on the top of which is this incredible megalithic structure. And the archaeologists and the geologists working here have been producing dates that are contemporary with Göbekli Tepe, but it's a lot more controversial at the moment. And obviously, Tiwanaku in Bolivia, there has been a lot of theories suggesting this might be 12,000 years old. Other people have talked about the Sphinx at Giza in Egypt by the Great Pyramids possibly being 12,000 years old. Something was going on at this time. There was obviously a motivation for construction. And if it can be confirmed that there was some kind of global civilization or a global mindset at this time that caused people to create these monuments, these structures, these megalithic monuments at this time, you know, we need to be looking at this, and we need to also be looking at the other structures around the world and saying, is it possible that they are far older than what we have ever imagined? I mean, there are megalithic temples in Malta, for instance, which are quite extraordinary. The Hypogeum, this underground structure, an architecture quite similar to Göbekli Tepe. I mean, could that be far older? There have been theories that suggest that it is, and various other parts of the world as well. Is it possible that, you know, we are looking at the remnants here of a real global lost civilization?
Maybe. Maybe. And maybe it also tells us of this incredible calamity that could have occurred even well after the flood.
Well, the flood seems to be a part of it. Obviously, the flood is a memory of the idea that there may have been rains. I mean, with a cataclysm like a comet, let's look at this for a moment. You've got these fragments of a comet coming out of the sky and creating these explosions, which probably took place before they even hit the Earth. They would have created these incredible wildfires that would have consumed vast areas and obviously decimated the animal life and the human populations. But all of the ash and the particles from these would have risen up in the sky and blotted out the sun, causing what we would now know as a nuclear winter. This would have blocked out any light from the sun or the moon for a period of time, maybe, you know, for a month.
Let's talk a little bit more about that cataclysm, Andrew, when we come back and take final calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Andrew Collins with us. Andrew, first of all, your book, Göbekli Tepe, is it available out there? Can people get it now?
Yeah, andrewcollins.com, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, the usual places, it's freely available in every format. And obviously, I welcome anybody to come on to andrewcollins.com if they've got any questions, you know, based on this interview.
All right, great. And it's a good read, by the way. And if you love adventures, this is exactly what it is. We were talking about the calamity. I'll let you go back and tell us more about that.
I mean, you know, I don't think we can imagine, you know, just how terrible. I mean, obviously, that there's going to be people out there that still have memories of the Second World War and, you know, the atomic bombs in Japan and things like this. But If you can imagine that, and maybe multiply it by 1,000 times, you know, this might give you an idea of what these cataclysms might have been like. You know, they would have created these incredible firestorms all over the world. Then you'd have had a period of darkness because of all the ash and the debris going up into the sky. Then, also because it would appear that the ice sheets were also vaporized at this time in the era of the Great Lakes, you'd have had all this water going up into the sky as well, and it would have rained back down with all of this particle. So you'd have had acid rain coming down for, you know, let's say 40 days, 40 nights, just like in the Bible tells us about the flood of Noah. And, you know, this would have caused these floods that would have completely consumed low-lying areas and drowned whole populations. And even after that, you've got other events going on, possibly further cataclysms, further comet impacts, for a period of several hundred years afterwards. This would have been a terrible time to live. And this is going to have an enormous impact on the human mindset. This catastrophobia, as I said, Barbara Hanclough refers to it, which I think is an incredible term that aptly describes the state of mind of human beings. And remember, there were no, you know, psychoanalysts, no psychologists back then that could help the people. The only people that could help them were the shamans, you know, those that would come in and try and say, look, you know, we've got a remedy. We can tell you how to get rid of this fear, but all you've got to do is do what we say, and we want you to create these incredible monuments like Göbekli Tepe, and then everything will be fine again. Because I actually believe that's what happened about 12,000 years ago.
Yet, I wish the information would still be so easily readable and available for people, Andrew, but it's not, is it? You really have to dig for it, literally.
Well, I mean, Göbekli Tepe is like a puzzle. And the carvings of the animals, the designs of the monuments, their orientation, you know, it's there to be solved. It's a puzzle to be solved. And that's what I've tried to do in this book. And I certainly know that various other of my colleagues are working on this as well. And, you know, it's as I said earlier on, it's like a smoking gun. It's something which we can work with now, something we know what the age is. We can try and get into the minds of the people that constructed it, a mind which is almost alien to us. The architecture they're creating is so different, so strange. That it's just compelling, and you just want to know what was going on at that time.
Okay, let's go to final calls now. We've got Scott, truck driving in Ohio, east of the Rockies. Scott, go ahead. Thank you.
Hi, thank you. First time caller, long time listener.
Great.
I'm curious as to where on timelines are these ancient civilizations found in the Bible? Like, if you were to compare, put the Bible down in timelines, like from, you know, the start of Adam and Eve all the way up through Noah's Ark and such. Is there some way that you can place all these civilizations that you find?
Scott, that's a very interesting question. And in the 17th century, there was a British theologian who added together all the different generations of the patriarchs and the different characters of the Bible, and worked out that the earth was made by God in 4004 BC. And if you go strictly by the Bible chronology, that's as far back as it goes. And what this has done is it's held us back from looking prior to this time at what might have taken place. But now that boundary is being smashed, because all the evidence suggests that humanity was around a lot longer. You know, civilization was around, as we say now, 12,000 years ago, the end of the last ice age. But there are some traditions outside of the Bible that talk about the pre-Adamic race, i.e. the time before Adam. And that's, I think, what we're talking about here. But I think that Adam and Eve are the memories, you know, this idealistic couple, I think, represent humanity at the point after this cataclysm. I think that they are the memory of the rejuvenation of the human race at this time. Similar couples are found within the creation myths and the catastrophe myths of indigenous peoples, different cultures, civilizations around the world. They talk about, you know, the fire, the flood, the time of darkness, and then two people emerge. Often they are brother and sister. Sometimes they survive on a boat, like obviously Noah and his family, and that they are the ones that repopulate the world. And this, I think, is a memory. And the idea of Adam and Eve and the sin and the fact of them being thrown out of paradise, having to then suffer mortality and to suffer, you know, life in the way which every other member of the human race now suffers because of them, according to the Bible, I think is a memory of these events and almost the way that we have punished ourselves because of what took place back then. It's almost like we as human race blamed ourselves for these bad things that happened in the world. And that's something that I think has been there for 12,000 years. And, you know, we blamed ourselves for what happened. I think that we believe that we'd done something wrong. You know, just like in the story of Atlantis, Zeus destroys Atlantis because the Atlanteans became too haughty. They became too clever. They started conquering, you know, other nations, things like that. So Zeus destroyed Atlantis. And this is another memory of this cataclysm. And this cataclysm, as I said, was a terrifying event, which is inside our collective minds. And I don't think has probably influenced everything that's occurred since that time, right up to this day.
Next up, we've got the Lord in Palm Springs, California. There you go. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Lord. Gentlemen, this is Lord. I'm so delighted to get on and talk with you folks.
Thank you.
I had a couple of items that I wanted to talk about real quickly. The Göbekli Tepe area is very close to Mount Ararat, just a few hundred miles. I'm wondering if perhaps Noah's Ark, if it landed in that area, might not be responsible for part of the things that went on there. I understand that there are carvings that don't represent many of the animals that appeared in the area, and perhaps or were native to the area, and perhaps these are some of the animals that came off of the Ark, and perhaps they were putting those on the pillars. And also regarding the pyramids, I tend to believe with Robert Schock that the pyramids are probably about 10,000 years older than they claim to be because of the water erosion on the Sphinx and that sort of thing. And also a thing I heard, I don't know if it was early this program or last night, where one of your guests said that the Nile used to be really right up at the doorstep, so to speak, of the Great Pyramid of Giza. And I'm wondering how long it would be, perhaps, before some of the traditional archaeology things might catch up with the actual facts on the ground, and people would start to relinquish some of the ideas that they have that don't seem to fit their particular outlooks. And I would love to hear what you have to say on those issues.
Well, again, some very interesting questions there. Firstly, Noah's Ark. The actual place that Noah's Ark came to rest is only about 150 miles to the east of Göbekli Tepe. It's very, very close. So the Garden of Eden, the place where Noah's Ark came to rest, and Göbekli Tepe are all in the same region. This is no coincidence. Then going on to Egypt and the age of the Sphinx and the Great Pyramids, Yep, certainly there's evidence to suggest that the Sphinx is far older than what the archaeologists tell us. Exactly how old, we don't know. It could be a few thousand years, it could be a few hundred years, it could be tens of thousands of years, we don't know. The pyramids were constructed on the plateau at Giza where the Sphinx were, and one of the reasons why those pyramids were constructed where they were, we now know, is because there were caves beneath the plateau at Giza. And it was myself and a colleague who discovered, but rediscovered for the first time in 200 years, those caves back in 2008. And it's something which I wrote about extensively in a book called Beneath the Pyramids. And nobody knew those caves were there. I mean, there were myths and legends about them, but we actually tracked down their location from an old diary, 200-year-old diary of an English explorer, and we pinpointed the exact location, and we actually went into a tomb which had never been written about other than one tiny mention in the 19th century. And we found the entrance into this incredible cave system, this natural cave system that had been there for tens, if not hundreds of thousands of years. And there was evidence of ancient activity down there. And we believe that the pyramid builders saw this as like the entrance into some kind of underworld, which symbolically the soul had to journey before it achieved rebirth in the afterlife amongst the stars. The pyramids there are also aligned to the constellation of Cygnus, the celestial cross, the Northern Cross as well. So there is a relationship between Göbekli Tepe, the Great Pyramid, and sites all over the world. You know, this is part of some kind of global consciousness that began tens of thousands of years ago and that was catapulted to new heights after this cataclysm, which almost destroyed the world. That's something that I think we should remember. And remember, it can always happen again. We should see this as a warning that, you know, these type of events can always occur again.
And Andrew, is there a biasness out there with some archaeologists?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, obviously, they have to toe the line, as it were. They have to keep to what their own textbooks say. But the guy who's actually in charge of Göbekli Tepe, a German by the name of Klaus Schmidt, is extremely forward-thinking. I mean, he's linked the Anunnaki with Göbekli Tepe, he's linked the Watchers with Göbekli Tepe, and he's linked the Garden of Eden. And that's an incredible advance, I think. And I think he needs to be given credit not only for the discovery of the place, but for linking these different mythological ideas, which are the ideas that I've brought together in Göbekli Tepe, Genesis of the Gods. And in fact, obviously, I've had interviews and conversations with this archaeologist, to make sure that his point is represented as well.
Let's go to Ryan in the state of Washington, west of the Rockies. Hey, Ryan, go ahead.
Yeah, hi, George and Andrew. I'll keep this quick for you guys, other callers. Hey, Andrew, I was just wondering, would you consider any megalithic things on some of the moons of Jupiter? And I was wondering what your idea of the megalithic approving lines, I think it's in Peru, it's in. And
the Nazca lines.
My answer up there.
The Nazca lines, that, okay? Sure thing. What do you think of those Nazca lines, Andrew?
Well, the Nazca lines are obviously a lot later. They probably only date to about 500-600 AD.
Right.
And some of the latest theories, which I like, is the fact that they are shaman's paths, that the shamans believe that they could leave the body and they would fly over the landscape and they would see these paths, the Nazca lines, plus all the different Nazca animals, and that they actually use them as directional navigation to enter the sky world, and that many of the different effigies on the ground represented different constellations, including Orion and including Cygnus, by the way. So the connection between Göbekli Tepe and Nazca lines is shamanism. And also, it is believed by archaeologists that the Nazca lines were created again after a local cataclysm, one where the rains never came for many, many decades, and that to appease the gods, to appease the celestial beings, they created the Nazca lines. So, you know, that I think is that. And as far as the megalithic architecture around the world, Göbekli Tepe is the first stone circles, and from this we get many thousands of years later Stonehenge and Avebury in southern England, and Newgrange in Ireland, Carnac in France, and indeed stone circles and dolmens and different types of huge stone structures all the way around the world. It's a global culture, and some of these monuments, you know, could date back to the time of Göbekli Tepe.
They very well may be. Andrew, we are rapidly out of time. Would you give us your website?
Yeah, it's www.andrewcollins.com. As I said, Göbekli Tepe, Genesis of the Gods, is available from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, from my own website. And if you want to come with us to Göbekli Tepe, we're going there at the end of May. Join us on the tour out there. You know, we're seeing.
When are you going to be there?
We're going there. I'm going there in 2 weeks' time. Yeah, two or three weeks' time.
Let's arrange something where you call into the program here and give us updates.
That would be incredible.
Would you do
let's
that?
Try and do that.
Okay,
yeah.
We'll set that up. Andrew, have a great night. Take care of yourself. Andrew Collins, Göbekli Tepe. It's an incredible story. Linda Moulton Howe reported on it some time ago, and it has just gotten bigger and bigger and bigger. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, George Knapp, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.